Good morning. Welcome to the NYU Migration Network's 15-minute explainers on aspects of U.S. immigration policy. My name is Josefina Saldana Portillo, an NYU professor of social and cultural analysis, the director of the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, and a member of the NYU Migration Network, a network of faculty and researchers who work on questions of migration and mobility across the university. This fall, we are hosting an event series to explore the implications of using enforcement as the core vector of immigration policy, with an emphasis on detention and deportation. Thus, we are offering a series of explainers that cover some of the key policy concepts involved in detention and deportation practices. You can find the recordings of today's explainer and future explainers on the NYU Migration Network website for you to share and return to. The address is migration.nyu.edu. On behalf of the network, I am absolutely delighted to introduce Adam Goodman, an associate professor of Latin American and Latino studies at the University of Illinois Chicago, who will tell us a bit about the history of deportation. Adam Goodman writes about migration, deportation, social movements, and U.S. immigration policy. His outstanding first book, The Deportation Machine, America's Long History of Expelling Immigrants, published by Princeton University in 2020, traces the federal government's systematic efforts to expel non-citizens over the past 140 years and has received multiple awards. In 2022 and 23, he was an Andrew W. Mellon Foundation Fellow at the Center for Advanced Study in Behavioral Sciences at Stanford University, and he currently serves on the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation's History Advisory Committee. Welcome, Adam. We're so lucky to have you here to explain U.S. Deportation history. And to start, what is the deportation machine?
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. I'm really happy to be here with you, Josie, in particular, and with all the colleagues who are joining us this morning and will be watching later. You know, the deportation machine, as I came to think of it, is actually something we don't know very much about historically. I mean, certainly deportation has been in the news lately. I'm sure it's on many people's minds as ICE raids are taking place in major cities and in small towns across the country. But there's actually a much longer history than most people are unfamiliar with. And as I jumped into this research about 15 or so years ago, I was startled to learn that the United States has deported more than 60 million people during the last century and a half. This isn't something that started in 2016 with the first election of Trump or with his re-election now. And actually, the United States has deported more people during the last century then it's allowed to remain in the country on a permanent basis. Another fact that startled me. This has been a bipartisan history, one in which Republicans and Democrats alike have promoted and implemented enforcement-first policies that have had devastating effects on the lives of not only non-citizens, but also many citizens and permanent residents as well. And most of the deportations have happened kind of out of public spotlight, and really with little to no due process. You know, this was another realization as I came to understand the deportation machine, is that the idea that an immigrant has their day in court and has the chance to kind of plead their case before an immigration judge, and then based on the merits, they'll determine whether or not the person's allowed to stay, isn't how 85% of people deported throughout US history have experienced the process of expulsion. Most people have been expelled through the euphemistically termed voluntary departures. You know, there's nothing voluntary about them. These are fast-track administrative expulsions that have happened at the hands of low-level immigration officials often. These are unilateral that haven't relied on the permission of another country saying that they'll accept whoever it is that is apprehended and being deported. And you know, these historically have made up, again, about 85% of the 60 million deportations. So there are a small slice of deportations that have happened through the formal expulsion mechanisms, which sometimes takes place in front of an immigration judge, sometimes not. Then there are these fast-track deportations, which we certainly have been thinking about a lot today since this has become increasingly what the Trump administration has relied on. And then something else that the Trump administration has really put, front and center is a combination of fear campaigns and scare tactics meant to get people to self-deport or to leave on their own, supposedly, in response to a really toxic environment that encourages people to leave because life has become so difficult in the United States that they see that as their best option. And I just want people to understand that there's a much longer history to what we're experiencing today, although there are some ways in which today also differs. So maybe we can get into that as the conversation unfolds.
Yes. But the next question I wanted to ask you was about the business of deportation. We're familiar with the prison industrial complex, but your book also delves into the business aspect. Can you tell us a little bit about that business aspect?
Certainly. This was another thing that I realized, that the growth of private prisons in recent years and headlines about GEO Group or CoreCivic, which is now Corrections Corporation of America, are rightfully in the news. And kind of the profit motive behind punitive policies is something we should take seriously. But this was also happening 100 years ago. I found letters in the archives of entrepreneurial individuals from the United States and also from other countries offering their services, whether it was scheduling tickets on steamships in the 1920s to deport people across the Atlantic or Pacific, or Mexican companies that were seeking to expel their compatriots on cargo boats and airplanes during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. And what I found was, first and foremost, the extraordinary human costs of enforcement policies that are driven by a combination, a toxic combination of profits and punishment. And these two have always been in play. On the one hand, you have companies and individuals proposing to provide services to expel people from the country at the lowest cost possible to win the contracts. And that has real implications for the conditions under which people are removed. But at the same time, you have the federal government that's actually hoping, in a way, that the whole process and experience will be punitive to serve as a deterrence mechanism for people to not return to the United States. So, just to give a quick example, in the 1950s, I traced the history of an operation that was known as the boat lift, during which about 50,000 Mexicans are apprehended and deported from all across the United States, transported to South Texas, the Port Isabel, Texas, right on the Gulf, and taken on ships that were used to transport bananas from Mexico, from the state of Tabasco, to places like Alabama. And then on the return trip, they'd pick up deportees, and they'd hold those deportees in the same holds as the bananas. And these companies deported tens of thousands of people rock bottom prices, and the experience was punitive in nature. There's extensive documentation of this, and the Immigration Service found that this was in fact an effective means. It didn't stop people from returning, but there's a one particular quote that just really sticks in my mind that I found in the archive from General Joseph Swing, who was the commissioner of the Immigration Naturalization Service at the time. And he said that the Mexicans hate the boat lift like the devil hates holy water. It's the most salutary thing we've hit upon yet. And so, this calls to mind more recent tactics such as prevention through deterrence in the 1990s, pushing people into the desert instead of crossing through more populated areas in hopes that it would serve the deterrence mechanism. But it served the Immigration Service's purposes as a deterrence mechanism. It served private individuals' interests as a means to make money off of human suffering, essentially. And what I just want to emphasize to everyone is that it's the state policies that created a market in deportable people. Different state policies would cut out these opportunities, but in fact, it's the state policies, as we're seeing today as well, that are driving these opportunities for people to profit off the suffering of others.
Thank you. Yes, I think what was it, $37 billion that finally made through the budget process to be dedicated to deportation. We don't have much time, so let's jump to the present. Is your book is amazing because it shows us that family separation has a very long history in the United States. But from your perspective, how is this new era of deportation with 3,000 people a week goals or 3,000 people a day goal set by the Trump administration. How does it differ from a previous periods of deportation, and how does it remain a constant?
It's an important question. It's one I've been thinking about a lot. Continuity, change over time, as historians are want to consider. But on the one hand, there are many things that I think we can see are similar. You know, the different mechanisms that I described at the beginning, those are still in play, and those are still largely the same mechanisms with some distinctions today compared to the past that the immigration agency is using to force, coerce, or encourage people into leaving the country. So those, remain the same in some sense. And you also have the fact that there's going to be long-term consequences. We don't know exactly what those will be yet, but whoever is targeted for apprehension and deportation, oftentimes, historically, there have been certain ideas and stereotypes and beliefs about belonging and who's an American and who's not, who's deserving and undeserving, and the disproportionate targeting of certain groups at certain points in time, whether it's the Chinese in the late 19th century, Southern Eastern Europeans at the turn of the 20th century, Mexicans for the last century, Central Americans really in the 21st century increasingly so, and today, it's a more diverse group of people who, really everyone in some sense, people who are in the country without authorization from all over the world are targets. So what the long-term effects of that will be, I think, we'll need to see how that plays out. But on the one hand, that's both a similarity and that though there will be long-term effects about questions of belonging and how these policies shape ideas of who's an American. And at the same time, the fact that who's targeted now is more diverse than it has been. This has been a really significant shift. Historically, Mexicans had made up about 90% of all deportees throughout U.S. history. We've seen that change dramatically in the last, several years. But one thing as well that's a real difference is that on the one hand, Trump is, turning to an old playbook largely, and in fact, making explicit references to other eras of history. At the same time, I can't think of another president who's made immigration the issue, the number one issue, and used it for his own political benefit and gain, both on the campaign trail and while in office. That hasn't been the case in other moments of U.S. history. And now a real big difference is that where historically you had people who had strong views about immigration and very much ideologically driven, they were on the fringes. Now they're at the center of power. They're in the White House. That's a significant difference that I don't think we can underestimate. And then the other thing that you alluded to earlier is that we've never seen such an infusion of funding when it comes to enforcement. I think the total immigration enforcement funding through the recent bill that was signed into law is going to be around $100 billion cumulatively. The federal government could have the ability to detain as many as 100,000 people at a time. Whether or not they'll be able to do this remains to be seen. There have been some recent reports about how there's much press and kind of news at a moment in time about the kind of the ramp up of ICE and the ramp up of a detention. And I think we'll see that playing out in the years ahead. But it might not be so easy to hire people. I mean, it might be so easy to retain people in those positions once they kind of see what they entail and who they're targeting. And we've seen public opinion polls shift even since Trump returned to the White House. And I think that that's something that we need to kind of keep an eye on. But what I do know is that I'm not sure what lies ahead, simply because the Immigration Service has always been limited by several factors in carrying out apprehensions and deportations, some political, many of them fiscal or economic. And the fiscal and economic limitations, now don't exist perhaps, but there's still questions about logistical issues and bureaucratic issues. But I do worry that whatever they are able to construct and build and to ramp up when it comes to enforcement will be much more difficult to dismantle later. In part just because of the bureaucratic inertia, and part because small communities who maybe now house detention centers depend on those jobs, there's all kinds of reasons why it could be difficult, and perhaps politically, for a Democrat or Republican, it could be difficult to say, I'm going to reduce the immigration enforcement staff and reduce the size of ICE. And politically, that could be challenging. And at the same time, I think it's more important than ever, to really take that on as an issue, and for politicians to develop a politics of immigration that centers those affected by this issue, which is everyone in the United States, and actually a set of policies that recognize the realities that migration has been the constant throughout U.S. history, regardless of what border regimes and immigration enforcement regimes are in place. The question always comes down to at what costs, and to whom. And I think that using that as a starting point leads us in a very different direction than the current set of policies that are in place.
Thank you so much, Adam. I think we are sadly out of time, but that was wonderful.
Well, thank you, Josie. I really appreciate it.